listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Years ago, I was the tender age of 19 when I married and my husband had just turned 20. 11 years later, when our marriage ended, my husband became suicidal. It was then that I realized that I had never thought of killing myself, even though my early childhood was full of many negative experiences and certainly short of love. We're told that each year, internationally, 1 million people die from suicide, one person every 14 minutes in the United States. Why do some people never consider suicide, and some think of it almost every day? That's part of what we're exploring today as I talk with Adele Royce about the first book in her trilogy on suicide entitled The Little Black Book of Suicide Notes. So welcome to Full Power Living. We're helping the world to realize and work with the importance, power, and mastery of human emotions. We welcome your questions and comments on the chats at blogtalkradio.com and also emotionalpro.com. And call now with questions or comments, 949-272-9450. That's a toll-free number, and you can talk with me and Adele Royce. Well, Adele Paula Royce resides in New York City. She has an artistic educational background, including the School of Visual Arts in New York City, and a degree in Fine Arts and English Literature from City University of New York. She worked her way into the corporate scene after finishing college, and then worked with a Jackson Pollock technique of colorful truth to secure her business relationships, envisioning corporations artistically as blank canvases. Then, more than 10 years ago, she began studying under a master teacher of Western spirituality, and she's been a student of Kabbalistic practice ever since. Adele Royce, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you so much, Eileen. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the show and to hopefully enlighten your audience and listeners, and to be able to bring this work that is, in my opinion, so vital to be brought to the forefront of existence. You know, it's something that's kind of shied away from. I sometimes say that there is a review on Amazon for The Little Black Book of Suicide Notes that I found very poignantly stated. And the person who wrote it had said the reason she was shying away from even reading the book was because she feared the subject matter. And I think then she purchased the book and she was very happy, and, you know, it goes on from there. Excuse me. But basically, the message that I'm trying to bring out is that this is a topic that has been really stigmatized and, for no uncertain terms, you know, been like pushed under a rock and in a closet, like so many vital issues of our time, and it needs to be spoken about to have the reward of change. You know, things don't change necessarily overnight, but this is something that is in the forefront due to its epidemic proportions at this point in time.
So, Adele, you set out to write a semi-fictional work, a trilogy about the topic of suicide. And we're talking about the first book in that trilogy today, The Little Black Book of Suicide Notes. But I'm curious about how you got drawn to share with the world the kind of thinking that goes on in somebody's mind when they're teetering between staying in this world and leaving it.
That's a very interesting question, and the perspective is coming from a very interesting place, might I add, from my observation. This novel is comprised of 27 suicide notes, and it's written by a woman on a spiritual journey from life to death to rebirth. They aren't suicide notes left behind. They are basically a series of reflections, journal entries of a sort, that chart her emotional and spiritual journey as she confronts the question of whether or not life is, in fact, worth living. And that's such a poignant point. It gives you an intimate look into the experience of hopelessness. And through her journey, it highlights her desire to find a way out. Now, many of us think of finding a way out by buying a $5,000 purse or, buying a very expensive home or car or boat or yacht or, all of the external worldly things that might change our state of being. But what this is all about is a journey inside, to realize that it's an internal look inside of oneself and to realize who you are and, in essence, what you're doing here. I wanted to share my story with the world and let people know who is suffering. And there are a lot of them out there based upon just the statistics that are out there about the suicidal rate. And the demographics, aside from that, are just mind-blowing. I mean, this isn't limited to people of 100 or 103 or 50 or 40. I mean, you're looking at demographics, Eileen, of children, of 10 to 13, 13 to 15, what states of mind someone might be in to, bring them to a point of hopelessness where they believe that there's nothing past that point. So I wanted to share this story, but along with this, I think you might find this very interesting, your audience as well, that after years of spiritual searching, and I don't want you to take this the wrong way, I had a realization that there really is no cure for suffering. And what I mean by that is I felt I needed to tell this in a way that would take the pressure off of people to find a solution that doesn't really exist. Through the story of this protagonist, you can follow her through the process of realizing that suffering is inherent to existence and how she comes to terms with it. When we think about it, it's kind of paradoxical. But the key insight here is that although human suffering is innate and it is inherent to the human condition, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And the point of people feeling alone in this journey, I want them to feel that they are not alone, because that is a very scary feeling. And the suicidal tendency is based on a feeling of hopelessness and not being able to experience anything beyond that feeling. And it's been my experience that once you realize what's really going on here in this game of life on this earth, not maybe the ones beyond or wherever the universe might take us from here, you can then begin to have more of a handle on how to relate to it and make peace with that truth.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. One of the things, now I'm very interested in emotions, and one of the things that really stood out to me as I read your book was that your narrator in the book is constantly in her head and not in her emotions very much, except for some negative emotions like despair. And I kept aching for this person who was not able to me, you have to get into your emotions in order to move through some of the things that she was struggling with. Do you have any comment on that?
Yes, I do. And it's very well put. You know, look, suicide is a very complex issue, and there are many different dimensions. You know, when you talk about the intellect as opposed to the emotional capacity, I mean, there's mental illness, there's brain chemistry. I'm not a doctor, but just from life experience, excuse me, there's family life, you know, our social structure, and much more. But what I wanted to explore and delve into in this book was the spiritual and moral dimensions, which are often overlooked by our society. You know, the fundamental feeling of this hopelessness and being alone, you know, Thoreau said it, and I quoted it in the book, and it's interesting to me, but it might be worth reading. It's just a brief paragraph. But it was in note one, and I think you'll find it very, very interesting. It was all about, you know, loneliness in terms of the emotional impact, so to speak, that it would basically have upon an individual. And it quotes by Thoreau, "It is easier to sail many thousand miles through cold and storming cannibals in a government ship with 500 men and boys to assist one, than it is to explore the private sea, the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean of one's being alone." So the state of loneliness is an emotional feeling. You know, feeling lonely and being alone are two different things. We know that. But lots of people don't. You know, I mean, you can be what I call as living in a state of emergency. A false state of emergency. And you with your work, I'm sure you must come across this for years of working with people on an emotional state. You know, a false state of emergency, from my observation, is reacting to something that feels real, but is not in essence true. You know, my teacher would always give two examples, which I believe would make the point well. You know, one true state of emergency could be, say, if someone were pointing a gun to your head, ready to pull the trigger. Another might be if a grizzly bear were coming toward you, ready to attack. You know, now those are true emergencies. Those are life and death situations. However, when one is full of fear, anxiety, pain, loneliness, devastation, and all of the other false selves and untruths that we are laden with, you know, even though they aren't actually under any kind of real threat, that may feel very real to the one experiencing it, but by no means is it true. And through this woman's story, you can learn that you don't have to live this way, and how that realization can result in living a much more balanced, sane, and simpler life.
You know, that's really well put. And I just almost tongue-in-cheek want to say that after reading the machinations she takes herself through over time, not only can you realize that she doesn't have to live that way, you just want to reach in the book and drag her out and say, stop living this way, because she seems to be lost in her own head, her own thoughts, her own perceptions, which I think we all get to that point, but there's no way out. And I was, I wanted to ask you, when she gets really lost in there, is there anything anybody on the outside can do to reach in and touch her in there?
I think that's what the whole story is about. I think this is the first part of a trilogy. This is book one of three books. And this book is taking you through the trials and tribulations of, and some of the misconceptions of life. So basically, you know, the associated element of craziness or insanity about it, I even wrote about it, you know, like I said, in the author's notes section, some of the brightest minds of our times committed suicide. You know, so if you're asking the question, is there anything that someone else can do, You know, I guess it's a case-by-case basis, but from my experience through life, and trust me, like a lot of people, I've had my own pain and suffering. You know, people bring to my attention, they say, well, Adele, how much of this book is, you know, fiction and how much is fact? You know, I say, well, that's a really interesting question. It's kind of a little bit of both, you know. It's fiction based on life experience. My teacher used to use a metaphor, you know, that was always really interesting to me. You know, say you're sleeping in bed at night, dreaming you're in Hawaii. Okay, so then the question becomes, are you in Hawaii or are you sleeping in your bed? So, like a lot of people, I've had my own struggles, and at times the ups and downs have not been so pretty to live with. And they still come. You know, they do still come. But I found a way out, and that's what I wanted to share with people. And when someone is feeling the intensity, like Thoreau wrote about, of being alone, you know, that's not a pretty feeling to deal with. And I think that's part of the issue that holistically this is bringing into focus and that I'm trying to bring out to the world, that you do not have to be alone. You don't have to hide under a rock. You don't need to hide in a closet. If more conversations were had, more parental conversations, maybe joining groups of more like-minded people, you know, all of these are ways of helping to bring you to the next point, you know? I mean, things don't happen necessarily overnight, although from my experience, sometimes things happen within a twinkling of an eye, you know? But basically, things are a slow and steady race to some point, not necessarily an end point, but the journey through what you're feeling and the journeying out of what you may be feeling. I mean, why would someone wake up one day and feel, ah, what a great day this is. It's so good to be alive. And then the next day you wake up and say, I just really don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to go to work. I don't want to go to school. I don't want to do whatever I am supposed to be doing today. You know, the human condition is complex. So it's part intellectual, part emotional, and your thoughts have a lot to do, as you're well aware, of your emotional state. So we try to take it from a different perspective. And as I say, I wanted to delve into it from more of a spiritual perspective and a more moral perspective, mental, moral, spiritual, you know, all of these elements that people sometimes overlook and think that it's such a cut and dry issue. It's not.
Yes. You remind me, I interviewed some time ago a psychiatrist named Dr. Peter Breggin. And as an undergraduate student, he went to school at Harvard. And they had a mental asylum there. And several students, I think there were 18 students, went into the asylum to work with people. These were the days before medication.
Yeah.
And so these students went in, and the hospital was afraid. Nobody ever got out of this hospital once they got in. And the hospital was afraid that these students were going to mess people up. So they picked their worst people, right? And for a year, these students met with these people one-on-one. 11 of those people left the hospital. And his point in telling that story is that it was the human contact, as you're saying, it was the human contact, the fact that one person cared, that seemed to make the difference. And I think 8 of those 11 actually stayed out of the hospital on an ongoing basis.
And that's a wonderful point, because, as I say, it's a kindred spirit reaching out to someone who may be on the ledge. You know, it's the homeopathic remedy of like cures like. You know, sometimes misery does like company, as odd as that may seem. You know, I wrote it in the book as well, and the author's note that, I mean, poetry does it very well. If you've ever read Shelley's, you know, Ozymandias, or John, you know, Clare's I Am, these poems speak of devastation. And, you know, some of the most beautiful artwork, some of the most, you know, you mentioned Jackson Pollock. He just happens to be one of my favorite artists. You know, he really went for the raw truth of life. You know, that's a very hard thing to do, very difficult thing to do, to find out what's really inside of yourself, you know, what's in that core. And sometimes, like I say, you're very pleasantly surprised. Sometimes if you dig deep enough, you know, it's not fear that you might find. You might strike gold. You know, it just takes a little courage. In this life, you know, Camus, and I just wanted to get back to that point for a moment because I think it's an interesting one to go through. I quoted in the book, Camus, in case your audience isn't familiar, was a French philosopher and writer, and I just loved his work. And, you know, he was getting to the bottom of some of life's biggest questions, and that could be very difficult, but it can be a very important process. And I believe that Camus nailed an essential philosophical question. You know, the quote was from his book, The Myth of Sisyphus, which explores this Greek mythological figure. And he's pushing a boulder up and up and up over this hill. And every time he gets to the top, the boulder starts rolling back down on him.
Right.
So, you know, the quote is similar to life. You know, the question is there more to life than pushing a boulder up a hill? You know, so I believe that our job is to keep moving forward. And little by little, maybe one fine day, with enough courage, that boulder makes it to the top and remains there. But it's only, you know, then that we can all answer for ourselves the fundamental question that Camus actually proposed, because you've experienced it for yourself. It's very experiential work. No one can do this for you. It's in essence an inside job. So when a person begins a journey inside of themselves, they may be, as I say, very pleasantly surprised to what they might find.
So, oh gosh, I had the question in my mind and I lost it.
I'm sorry.
Oh,
sometimes
I know what it was.
Talk a lot.
No. It has to do with this. I read recently that our world is very materialistic right now, which I think we can all agree to, and that it's going to go on for a long time. And I may be mistaken, but I think part of the way out that you found was through not materialistic ways, something to balance that materialism. Is that
yes.
so?
Yes. Yes. What I want you to bring to the readers was the word hope with a double exclamation point, you know, to realize that there is a way out other than a destructive one. You know, we're going here from an enslavement to freedom. And how do you do that? You know, the question becomes, how do you do something like that? If you continue on a materialistic path, you know, some of the, I say you, all roads lead to Rome. You can study the spiritual aspects. You can study the cultural aspects from the east, the west, the north, the south. But all roads are going to lead you to Rome. They're going to lead you to the moment you're living in. They're going to be telling you basically that the past is dead, buried, gone. They're going to be telling you that the future is stories made up of things that don't even exist and, you know, brought to the nth degree can bring you into a state, I believe, of schizophrenia. You know, you're making up stories of things that you have no clue as to what might happen in the next nanosecond. So what you are left with is the moment. Within that moment, getting to the next moment is the moment, and then getting to the moment past that is the next moment. So it is a very singular process, and it has nothing to do with economics. I mean, you know, somebody, and again, don't take this wrong, but somebody once made a very funny analogy that I thought was funny anyway, you know, that money is just pieces of paper with pictures of dead people on it, you know, and I always, it just stuck in my head, you know, it can buy you things. Yes, it can buy you some, in quotes, freedom. Maybe you wouldn't have to get up and work every day or set an alarm at 5 o'clock if you didn't choose to do something like that, but it has nothing to do with your inner state of being, you know. In certain cultures, you know, they say that, you know, you can't respect two gods, you know, money and God, so to speak. You need to focus on what is important in this life. And what's important in this life, and I think it was reiterated to me the other evening, I watched one of my all-time favorite movies, actually, Into the Wild. And again, if your audience isn't familiar, it was based on a true story, a kind of rites of passage of a gentleman that was going, you know, through his own inner turmoil, and he was trying to find his way out. And you know, the first thing he did was basically take his money and burn it. And I thought that was a very significant, a significant gesture of what was to come. And I was thinking about that over the last couple of days. And I myself can tell you from personal experience that I've had a wonderful career, you know, in marketing and sales. And I basically, you know, every job got to the next one and the career kept building and more money started coming in. And, oh, wow, if I make this, how fabulous it'll be. And, oh, the next job came in because I had more connectivity to people they wanted to reach. And, oh, they'll pay me more money, you know. And what did it culminate in? It culminated in writing a book about suicide. So, you know, I say it poignantly and paradoxically, but I say it with a great element of truth. I mean, you can take people and, you know, I mean, I'll mention a name here, they're famous people, so it's not with any ill intent. You know, you take people such as Eckhart Tolle, who is a wonderful spiritual teacher from my observation. You know, I listen to his work on many occasions. And I listen to my spiritual teacher who's taught me how to live. And basically, you know, he keeps telling me, you teach yourself, you know, I'm the catalyst. But, you know, as a student of work, you are very grateful for, you know, all of the instances that bring you a little closer to who you really are. Sometimes it's just so clouded in your emotional state that you really don't know who you are. And once you start digging a little deep, like I said, you might find something very, very cool.
Yes, I think that's what I found when I finally faced myself. It's time for us to have a break, Adele. I want you to call 949-272-9450 if you have comments or questions. And Adele, when we return, I had an experience with someone with whom I was working many years ago that really taught me a lot about suicide. And I'd like to share the story with you and get some of your insights or reactions to what I discovered as part of this conversation. Okay?
It would be my pleasure.
All right. You're listening to Full Power Living. We'll be right back.
You and everyone you know have been born to learn. All humans are on Earth to attend school. People know this intuitively, but they don't really live by it. And now you can. I'm Eileen Dillon. Born to Learn is the title of my latest book, available at emotionalpro.com. The result of 30 years of investigation, which gives you the big picture and the instruction book. Born to Learn gives you information you need to turn your problems into puzzles and then solve them. Life is kinder when we complete our homework assignments. Start today. order Born to Learn at emotionalpro.com and get a leg up on your life.
Welcome back. Call in now to share your ideas and thoughts about suicide. Our number is 949-272-9450. And I'm talking today with art lover, spiritual seeker, and author of the Little Black Book of Suicide Notes, Adele Royce. So before we get back into our regular question, I have a couple of messages. Next week, we're going to be looking at what the sexual revolution has done to our sexual attitudes and behaviors today. I'm going to be talking with Stanford University psychiatrist, Dr. Susan Edelman, who's author of Be Your Own Brand of Sexy. In the 1950s, the rules about sex and sexual behavior clearer than they are today. And so join me next Thursday to get Dr. Edelman's suggestions of what you can do to make things clearer for you. That's Thursday, March 2nd at 9 a.m. Pacific time. Now, in March, we're going to be taking a sabbatical from Full Power Living until the fall of 2017. And in the meantime, we have many wonderful shows available for you. We have close to 600 shows from the last 13 years of broadcasting, and you can access them on emotionalpro.com or on blogtalkradio.com, and we still have our subscription to Full Power Living on iTunes. So we've been broadcasting since 2004, so please take advantage of that and go to emotionalpro.com and get yourself on our mailing list so you get the announcement of when we start again. So today I'm talking with a student of Kabbalistic practice and author of the Little Black Book of Suicide Notes, Adele Royce. Now, Adele, before the break, I said I have a person that I worked with. I worked with an 18-year-old woman. And yeah. In the first session that I worked with her, she told me that she was carrying a double-edged razor blade in her wallet. She was so depressed, she believed that she needed to kill herself, and she was just prepared to do it the minute she was moved to do so. And I knew of this person beforehand. She came from a well-to-do and well-respected family. She was an only child. But as you explore in your book, she couldn't find any reason to live. And that was very puzzling to me. Why when it appears that somebody has everything, are they still thinking of killing themselves? Is finding out who we are so important that if we're not clear on who we are, that's enough?
I think that, first of all, that's a very touching story. And I think it well defines what we're discussing here in that, the Little Black Book of Suicide Notes, and again, I'm going back to this because it will circle back to what you're talking about, is the first book of a planned trilogy. Okay, there are two books to follow. So basically, the second book is going to be Notes from the Beyond, and the third is going to be Returning to This Mortal Coil. So we're going to be taking a journey together from enslavement to freedom, basically. This book is the first of a trilogy, and it's about life, its trials, tribulations, and as I said in the first part of the show, its misconceptions. But we're then going to go on a journey through death, and we're going to explore in novel form with those who have died tragic and intentional deaths by their own hands and find out what's actually beyond. And then, to your point and your story, we're going to be traveling back to, as the subtitle of this book is, to finding life in a new way. We're going to be coming back in a new way. Now, how actually does one do this? Well, you come back to this life by writing your own scroll. You can rewrite your life story. You don't have to live with the one that you think you own. You have a chance to write your own life story, write a new scroll. You know, maybe at times, say the person you were describing just doesn't know what that picture looks like just yet, you know? So I would say stay tuned for some fascinating ideas and experiences coming everyone's way to kind of learn how you actually come through who you think you are to who you actually are.
That's a really great point. So I have a couple more little things I want to share about this woman. I got her agreement that she would throw her razor blade away and promised me that she would not put another one in her wallet as long as she and I were working together, because I said to her, it's a waste of her money and time and my money and time for us to be working to help her live a better life if she wasn't thinking she was going to live long enough, you know, for us to do that. And she worked with me for several sessions, and we untangled a lot of the pain. My aim was to give her something to hold on to. And I'm telling this story because I noticed in your book that your narrator seems unable to untangle her pain, no matter what. She complains that she's done therapy and she's gone to her, I don't know, her rabbi or her minister, and she just can't find her way out. What you said, you found your way out. What was the catalyst that helped you to do that?
I would say that the catalyst to going through this book to the next one to find a way out, and then to the third book to actually find out what it's all about, was researching so many different facets of the human condition. I mean, if you take this issue of suicide, it's a very complex issue. And again, I go through it once again because it's important. Mental illness, brain chemistry, family life, social culture, and it keeps going on and on. But basically, if you take someone like Viktor Frankl that I had mentioned before, and it's worth mentioning again, you know, he was in the concentration camps, all right? And, you know, the only thing that he felt that the captors could not take from him was his internal freedom. And that is not something, once again, that can be surgically removed. So the book is about finding a path to your own internal freedom. Now, the protagonist might have been in quite a bit of turmoil, which most of society is in one which way, shape, or manner. I mean, the doctor, Dr. Gerald Epstein, who is my teacher, wrote the foreword to this book, and he was very clear on many facets of this particular issue of finding your own freedom, of what this is all about, of, you know, the spiritual, mental, moral, social, and emotional aspects of what a person goes through, and that, in fact, most people are committing, you know, the act of suicide in one way or another, not even realizing it on a daily basis, you know? So it's not just the actual act of the suicidal act. It's the emotional and mental and spiritual components that go into the dynamism of one's personality. And it's based on conditioning. I mean, again, I go back to your work. You've seen this over all of the years. I'm sure you've seen more than I care to think about. But, you know, I mean, again, that's facing truth. It is what it is and not what we all think it should be, you know. So I just believe that in the darkest, darkest moments that someone might be experiencing, if they could hang in there and realize a very important element, they are not alone. They are not alone. People have been there, done that, and come through the other side. And once this is brought to the forefront, I don't believe you're going to be seeing 13-year-old children dealing with suicide. I don't think you're going to be seeing as much of the, I mean, take the military. You know, suicide is outranking combat deaths in the military in some areas.
Yes.
When you're looking at epidemic proportions of something, you really need to take the time and effort and energy. If you're going to utilize your energy in a positive way, you know, instead of maybe purchasing a $5,000 purse, so to speak, and I'm just using a hypothetical situation, maybe to utilize that energy to do something of a positive aspect for the world, to bring some sort of a spark into the world. Because homeopathy, as you know, just takes one spark. You know, a little cures a lot. It's like taking that one little spark. I mean, when you look at 9/11, and I go back to that because to me it's just a fascinating correlation of what this relationship is. You had 19 people, I believe, come into this country, and basically what they did was with a very unsophisticated type of weapon, I believe it was a box cart, change the course of the world. It's homeopathy. A little does a lot, whether it does it in a positive way or it may do it in a negative way. That, you know, is something that is out there. But yes, what we're trying to do here is to let people know that there is hope. They are not alone. Pain and suffering is inherent in the human condition, and that there is a way out. And there are lots of ways to find it.
Good. I want to tell you one more aspect of my work with this woman and get your comment on what I believe I discovered. She dropped out of therapy after a few months, and I didn't see her for a while, and I ran into her on the street one day about 6 months later, and she was happy, and she stopped to talk with me, and I was absolutely amazed at what she told me. She was working, remember, she's from a prominent family and an only child. She was working at a nursing home as a dishwasher. She was dating a fellow dishwasher. And she was enrolled in a motorcycle maintenance course. And she wasn't carrying a razor blade in her wallet anymore. And she wasn't consumed with thoughts of suicide. So let me tell you what I learned from her as I thought about the situation with her. I have worked with a lot of people over the years who work really hard in their lives, and no matter how hard they work, things don't work out for them. It's almost like they're on a layer of air and they don't connect with the earth.
Right.
And I had this thought that every person who comes to the earth needs to decide if they really intend to stay here. And until we intend to stay here, things don't work out for us. And once this young woman decided she would stay here, she literally went to get her hands dirty. What's your comment?
Interestingly enough, I mean, you can take it back to a nth degree in the very beginning of coming into this world as an infant. You know, why would someone be stillborn? Maybe, and again, I wasn't at the table when this might have happened, so I'm just speculating, but maybe that child, prior to its birth, decided that they just didn't want to be here. And there you have a stillbirth, you know. So that might be a simple answer to a very interesting question as to the capability of the human and what they are able to accomplish if they want to accomplish something. You know, again, it goes back to desire. Do I want to be here or don't I want to be here? You know, I mean, you can look at any type of an individual. I mean, why do people give up lucrative careers in finance or, you know, in entertainment to go into monasteries and, you know, into caves in the Himalayas and maybe become a monk and spend their days meditating and, divorce themselves of any type of materialism, you know, that one might be aware of. It's a desire. It's an internal desire to do something. And sometimes people just don't know what to do. You know, this book is kind of a catalyst to take you through to realize that, hey, listen, I might be feeling this way and I might be going through this, but somehow there is something telling me to keep going. Just keep putting one, you know, foot in front of the other and see what's there. In my darkest moments, I always had this vision that everything was going to be perfect. Somehow everything was going to come out and be beautiful. And you want to know something? Sometimes I really do experience that. Not all the time, but sometimes I do. And at those moments, I am so grateful for the whole idea and the whole concept that I would be able to share that with people, to let them know that they're not alone in their bleakest moments and that there is a light at the end of the tunnel and that pain is not a given. It's there. It's a fact. You need to deal with the facts, not make up stories about them. You know, one of the saints, I believe, said, face what's in front of you and the rest will be revealed. And I kind of live my life that way, and I found it a very productive way to be.
I totally agree. To tie back in with some other things that you said, I once heard a yogi from India talking about the path to freedom in facing fact, looking at things squarely for what they are. So I think that's, I totally agree with you. Now, one of the places that was both difficult for me to read and also inspiring for me to read was your section in the book called The Ten Commandments of Suicide. And it was difficult because you literally go to religion or religious ideas, and your narrator just seems to be going in circles. There's just like no way she can get free at all. The religion just ties her up like she's a calf in a rodeo that's been roped. So tell us a little bit about that portion of your book.
Well, I always say that my favorite authors are, number one, Hemingway, because he always spoke to me in pictures, and every time I have a desire to go to Paris, I always reread A Movable Feast, you know. But the other book is the Bible. I keep it on my night table for inspiration when I feel like reading. And it is, I wasn't, again, at the table when they wrote it. So I don't know if it's just a really great piece of wisdom literature or, in fact, if it's just a piece of great literature. But I believe there's a relationship, you know, and I'm talking about the Bible in total, New Testament, Old Testament. The first five books are enthralling to me. And the Gospels I found very intriguing. So I felt that it was a tie-in and a relationship between life, death, and rebirth. And that's where all of that came from. It was less to do with theology, a little less to do with religion than one might anticipate. But there were quotes and there were sections, I believe from Revelation, you know, that I thought were poignantly stated and people could relate to in terms of what some of the wisdom literature, you know, might really have to say. I mean, sometimes you look, you know, I had taken a trip to Israel. I always go back to this point because it was such a life-changing situation for me. Back in 2008, I believe, when they were bombing Gaza, and I had gotten out 2 days before the ground war actually started. But wow. It was a way of life for these people. You know, they're on cell phones, walking around the streets with Uzi machine guns on their back, and these were kids, maybe, you know, 18, 19, 20. But the point that I wanted to make was there was a Dome of the Rock. And the Dome of the Rock was basically a mosque, and it was in Jerusalem. And you have a Muslim tradition, you have Judaism, you have Christianity. You know, the world was all looking at this as their rock. And you wonder why there's no peace in the world. Well, if you take that and analogize it to your own internal self, you wonder if there are more of those facets inside of yourself to reconcile with and make some peace with. So taking a look inside of oneself, as I made analogies to the biblical scriptures, I think is a helpful way of one to, again, reconcile with the fact that this has been going on for 5,000 years and then some, and it's nothing new, you know, and maybe one day it'll be very old and no one will have to deal with it. But in the meantime, we are dealing with it, and it's something that needs to be dealt with. And I believe that the Little Black Book of Suicide Notes is going to be a help and a balm, and I say that in the way of the BALM, to many people who are struggling and trying to find a way out of their own pain.
Something you brought up there, and I know that you've written the Little Black Book of Suicide in order to be something for people to hold on to, but you said we need to look inside of ourselves, and the question that comes is, what do you hold on to while you're busy looking inside of yourself when you're not fully grounded here in the world?
I think what's necessary, from my experience again, is finding a group of like-minded people, maybe a teacher or some sort of a group or anything that might bring you some relief, you know, in a productive way at that point in time, and see what works for you. You know, it's all a seeking out process of trying something. Maybe this works, maybe this doesn't work. Again, going back, Eileen, to why do some people study Eastern philosophy? Why do some go with Western tradition? You know, it's just something that might appeal to, something that resonates with you is, I guess, the best word I'm looking for. When something, you tap into these things experientially, you learn for yourself what resonates with you, and you follow through with it. But once you find a path, and this is an important point that I'd like to make, you stick with it. You dig deep. You dig deep in that path and you don't start mixing things up. You know, I mean, in the Bible, it's basically known as adultery, you know, mixing. But the way I learned it is that you find something that resonates and you dig and you find.
That is very wonderful advice. I totally agree with you. Well, you know, It's very interesting to me as a therapist here in California. Therapists have the job of protecting people from killing themselves. And I don't want anyone to kill themselves, but I, as a therapist over the years, have really felt that people have a right to be self-directing. And I like that you're offering that the best self-direction is to dig deep inside of yourself and find out who you are and perhaps also what you brought yourself here to do, and that will straighten a lot of this out. So I really want to thank you for, you know, delving into this project. By the way, when is your second book coming out?
Well, the first one was just released on Valentine's Day. And the book launch was really interesting because, you know, people would say to me, you know, Valentine's Day, suicide, you know, what is the correlation here? You know, and it may seem very contradictory to launch a book on Valentine's Day regarding suicide, but it's actually very appropriate. You know, Valentine's Day is one of the most gloomiest days of the year for those who are suffering. And in fact, the suicide hotline numbers get more calls on Valentine's Day than most other times of the year. You know, and it's again the societal pressure that you should be happy and feel in love and all of these positive emotions, when basically it's okay to struggle and feel blue, even if it seems that the whole world is seeing roses. You know, the society's relentless need for everything to appear okay and just fine is not cutting it anymore. And I think it makes it difficult for any of us to experience depressing emotions, which are inevitable, in a healthy and an integrated way. You know, this dynamic is stronger than ever on certain days and times of the year. And when you're feeling it on a day-to-day basis, you know, that's kind of the time to start searching really hard and look fast and deep. But in answer to your question, once again, the other books are in the works. And the second book hopefully will be out, I hope, sooner than later. We're getting through the first at this point in time. You know, lots of radio and lots of media because it's been very well received. The audio book just came out. I'm very proud of that piece of work. I actually do the reading myself. It was like Bob Dylan, who's one of my favorite artists. Basically, you know, he always wanted to sing his own songs because he knew just how he wanted his song sung. Well, I did the reading because I knew exactly how I wanted these notes to be read. Right. And there's also a bonus track of Suicide is Painless from the movie MASH that was covered by a brilliant artist, Tony Noe. And that's also in the audiobook. So it's a very special piece of artwork relating to this topic. And, you know, if you don't care for the paperback or the e, there's the audiobook. So,
great.
Yeah, it's quite a large project. So in answer to your question once again, and I don't want to get too off topic, is that the other books are coming. And I hope ASAP, but they will come when they are ready to come.
All right. That's I certainly understand that answer. I just wanted to give people something to look forward to. And you mentioned, you know, the suicide prevention hotline, lifeline. I have the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, which is 800-273-8255. They're available 24 hours a day, and I wanted to be sure to include that here. So, Adele, it's a very fascinating book. I agree with you. The topic needs to be revealed in our culture, and I thank you for writing it and also for appearing here on Full Power Living today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So, next week, Stanford psychiatrist Dr. Susan Edelman will be here to talk about her ideas from her book, Be Your Own Kind of Sexy. She's addressing the new issues around sex, sexiness, and sexuality that have arisen because of and after the sexual revolution of past years. So be here again next Thursday, February 2nd. And if you can't be here in person, listen on our archives on emotionalpro.com or Blog Talk Radio, or subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes. Our producer is Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Paul, for now. I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
To Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.